Chapter 3 Pale Shadows. Seizing Sidene, Rand channeled, wove flows of air that snatched Natale up from the cushions. The gilded harp tumbled to the dark red tiles as the man was pinned against the wall, immobile from neck to ankles, and his feet half a pace above the floor.
"I've warned you. Never channel when anyone else is around. Never!"
Natale tilted his head in that peculiar way he had, as if trying to look at Rand sideways or watch without being noticed.
"If she had seen, she would have thought it was you."
There was no apology in his voice, no diffidence, but no challenge either. He seemed to think he was offering a reasonable explanation.
"Besides, you look thirsty. A court bard should look after his lord's needs."
That was one of the small conceits he surrounded himself with. If Rand was the Lord Dragon, then he himself must be a court bard, not a simple gleeman. Feeling disgusted with himself, as much as angry at the man, Rand unraveled the weave and let him drop. Manhandling him was like picking a fight with a boy of 10. He could not see the shield that constricted the other man's access to Sidene. It was female work, but he knew it was there. Moving a goblet was about the extent of Natale's ability now. Luckily, the shield had been hidden from female eyes, too. Natale called the trick inverting. He did not seem able to explain it, though.
"And if she had seen my face and was suspicious, I was as startled as if that goblet had flown at me by itself."
He stuck his pipe back between his teeth and sent up furious streams of smoke.
"She still wouldn't suspect."
Settling back under the cushions, the other man took up the harp again, strumming a line of music that had a devious sound.
"How could anyone suspect? I do not entirely believe the situation myself."
If there was even a touch of bitterness in his voice, Rand could not detect it. He was not entirely sure he believed it either, though he had worked hard enough for it. The man in front of him, Jason Natale, had another name, Asmodian. Idly playing the harp, Asmodian did not look like one of the dreaded Forsaken. He was even moderately handsome. Rand supposed he would be attractive to women. It often seemed strange that evil had left no outward mark. He was one of the Forsaken, and far from trying to kill him, Rand hid what he was from Moraine and everyone else. He needed a teacher. If what was true for the women Aes Sedai called Wilders also held for men, he had only one chance in four of surviving the attempt to learn to use the power on his own. That was discounting the madness. His teacher had to be a man. Moraine and others had told him often enough that a bird could not teach a fish to fly, nor a fish a bird to swim. And his teacher had to be someone experienced, someone who already knew all the things he needed to learn. With Aes Sedai gentling men who could channel as soon as they were found, and fewer were found every year, that left small choices. A man who had simply discovered he could channel would know no more than he did. A false dragon who could channel, if Rand could find one not already caught and gentled, would not be likely to give up his own dreams of glory for another claiming to be the dragon reborn. What remained, what Rand had lured to him, was one of the Forsaken. Asmodian plucked random chords as Rand took a seat on a cushion facing him. It was well to remember that the man had not changed, not inside, from the day so long ago when he had pledged his soul to the Shadow. What he did now, he did under duress. He had not come to the light. "Do you ever think of turning back, Natale?" He was always careful of the name. One breath of Asmodian, and Moraine would be sure he had gone over to the Shadow. Moraine, and maybe others. Neither he nor Asmodian might survive that. The man's hands froze on the strings, his face utterly blank.
"Turn back.
Demandred, Ravin, any of them would kill me on sight now.
If I was lucky.
Except Lanvir, perhaps, and you will understand if I don't want to put her to the test.
Semirag could make a boulder beg for mercy and thank her for death. And as for the great lord...
The Dark One, Rand broke in sharply around his pipe stem. The great lord of the dark was what dark friends called the Dark One. Dark friends and the Forsaken. Asmodian bowed his head briefly in acquiescence.
When the Dark One breaks free.
If his face had been expressionless before, now it was bleak in every line.
Suffice it to say that I will find Semirhag and give myself to her before I'll face the Dark One's punishment for betrayal.
As well you are here to teach me, then. Mournful music began to flow from the harp, speaking of loss and tears.
The March of Death, Asmodian said over the music, the final movement of the Grand Passions cycle, composed some 300 years before the War of Power by...
Rand cut him off. You are not teaching me very well.
As well as may be expected under the circumstances. You can grasp Sidene every time you try now, and tell one flow from another. You can shield yourself, and the power does what you want it to.
He stopped playing and frowned, not looking at Rand.
Do you think Lanfear really intended me to teach you everything? If she had wanted that, she would have contrived to stay close, so she could link us. She wants you to live, Luz Theron. But this time she means to be stronger than you.
Don't call me that,
Rand snapped, but Asmodian did not seem to hear.
If you planned this between you, trapping me...
Rand sensed a surge in Asmodian as if the Forsaken were testing the shield Lanfear had woven around him. Women who could channel saw a glow surrounding another woman who had embraced Thaidar and felt her channeling clearly, but he never saw anything around Asmodian and felt little.
If you worked it out together, then you let her outfox you on more levels than one. I've told you I am not a very good teacher, especially without a link. You did plan it between you, didn't you?
He did look at Rand then, sidelong but still intent.
How much do you remember? Of being Luz Theron, I mean.
She said you recalled nothing at all, but she could lie to the Dark One himself.
This time she spoke the truth. Seating himself on one of the cushions, Rand channeled one of the clan chief's untouched silver goblets to him. Even such a brief touch of Sidene was exhilarating and fouling, and hard to release. He did not want to talk about Luz Theron. He was tired of people thinking he was Luz Theron. The bowl of his pipe had grown hot with all the puffing, so he held it by the stem and gestured with it.
If linking will help you teach me, why don't we link?
Asmodian looked at him as if he had asked why they did not eat rocks, then shook his head.
I continually forget how much you don't know. You and I cannot. Not without a woman to join us. You could ask Moraine, I suppose, or the girl Egwene. One of them might be able to reason out the method, so long as you don't mind them finding out who I am.
Don't lie to me, Natale, Rand growled.
Well before meeting Natale, he had learned that a man's channeling and a woman's were as different as men and women themselves, but he took little the man said on trust.
I've heard Egwene and others talk about Aes Sedai linking their powers. If they can do it, why not you and I?
Because we can't.
Exasperation filled Asmodian's tone.
Ask a philosopher if you want to know why. Why can't dogs fly? Perhaps in the grand scheme of the pattern, it's a balance for men being stronger. We cannot link without them, but they can without us. Up to 13 of them can, anyway. A small mercy. After that, they need men to make the circle larger.
Rand was sure he had caught a lie this time. Moraine said that in the Age of Legends, men and women had been equally strong in the power, and she could not lie. He said as much, adding, "The five powers are equal."
Earth, fire, air, water, and spirit, Natale strummed a chord for each. They are equal, true, and it is also true that what a man can do with one, a woman can also. in kind, at least. But that has nothing to do with men being stronger. What Moraine believes to be true, she tells as truth, whether or not it is. One of a thousand weaknesses in those fool oaths.
He played a bit of something that did indeed sound foolish.
Some women have stronger arms than some men, but in general it is the other way around. The same holds with strength and the power, and in about the same proportion.
Rand nodded slowly. It did make a kind of sense.
Elaine and Egwene were considered two of the strongest women to train in the tower for 1,000 years or more. But he had tested himself against them once, and later Elaine had confessed that she felt like a kitten seized by a mastiff.
Asmodian was not finished.
If two women link, they do not double their strength. Linking is not as simple as adding together the power of each. But if they are strong enough, they can match a man. And when they take the circle to 13, then you must be wary. 13 women who can barely channel could overpower most men, linked. The 13 weakest women in the tower could overpower you, or any man, and barely breathe hard. I came across a saying in Ara Daman. The more women there are about, the softer a wise man's steps. It would not be bad to remember it.
Rand shivered, thinking of a time when he had been among more than 13 Aes Sedai. Of course, most of them had not known who he was. If they had, if Egwene and Moraine linked. He did not want to believe Egwene had gone that far toward the tower and away from their friendship. Whatever she does with her whole heart, and she's becoming Aes Sedai. So is Elaine.
Swallowing half his wine did not completely wash the thought away.
What more can you tell me about the Forsaken? It was a question he was sure he had asked 100 times, but he always hoped there was a scrap more to dig out. Better than thinking about Moraine and Egwene linking to...
I have told you everything I know.
Asmodian sighed heavily.
We are hardly close friends at the best. Do you believe I'm holding back something? I don't know where the others are, if that is what you want. Except Samael. And you knew he'd taken Ilion for his kingdom before I told you. Grendel was in Ara Daman for a time, but I expect she is gone now. She likes her comforts too well. I suspect Mogadian is or was in the west somewhere as well. But no one ever finds the spider unless she wants to be found. Ravin has a queen for one of his pets, but your guess is as good as mine as to what country she rules for him. And that is all I know that might help locate them.
Rand had heard all that before. It seemed he had heard all Asmodian had to say of the Forsaken 50 times already. So often that at moments it seemed he had always known what the man was telling him. Some of it he almost wished he had never learned, what Semirag found amusing, for instance. And some made no sense.
Demandred had gone over to the Shadow because he envied Luz Theron Telamon.
Rand could not imagine envying someone enough to do anything because of it, and surely not that. Asmodian claimed it had been the thought of immortality, of endless ages of music, that seduced him. He claimed to have been a noted composer of music before. Senseless.
Yet in that mass of often blood-chilling knowledge might lie keys to surviving Tarmangaedon. Whatever he told Moraine, he knew he would have to face them then, if not before. Emptying the goblet, he set it on the floor tiles. Wine would not wash out facts. The bead curtain rattled, and he looked over his shoulder as Gaishain entered, white-robed and silent. While some began gathering up the food and drink that had been laid out for him and the chiefs, another, a man, carried a large silver tray to the table. On it were covered dishes, a silver cup, and 2 large green-striped pottery pitchers. One would hold wine, the other water. A Gaishain woman brought in a gilded lamp, already lit, and set it beside the tray. Through the windows, the sky was beginning to take on the yellow-red of sunset. In the brief time between baking and freezing, the air actually felt comfortable. Rand stood as the Gaishain departed.
but did not follow immediately. "What do you think of my chances when the last battle comes, Natale?" Asmodian hesitated, and pulling red and blue-striped wool blankets from behind his cushions and looked up at him, head tilted in that sideways manner of his.
"You found something in the square the day we met here."
"Forget that," Rand said harshly. There had been two, not one. "I destroyed it in any case." He thought Asmodian's shoulders slumped a trifle.
"Then the Dark One will consume you alive. As for me, I intend to open my veins the hour I know he is free, if I get the chance. A quick death is better than what I'll find elsewhere."
He tossed the blankets aside and sat staring glumly at nothing. "Better than going mad, certainly. I'm as subject to that as you now. You broke the bonds that protected me." There was no bitterness in his voice, only hopelessness. "What if there was another way to shield against the taint?" Rand demanded. "What if it could be removed somehow? Would you kill yourself then?" Asmodian's barked laugh was utterly acid.
"The shadow take me, you must be beginning to think you really are the bloody creator. We are dead, both of us, dead. Are you too blind with pride to see it, or just too thick-witted, you hopeless shepherd?"
Rand refused to be drawn.
"Then why not go ahead and end it?" he asked in a tight voice.
"I wasn't too blind to see what you and Lanfear were up to. I wasn't too thick-witted to fool her and trap you."
"If there's no hope, no chance, not the smallest shred, then why are you still alive?"
Still not looking at him, Asmodian rubbed the side of his nose.
"I once saw a man hanging from a cliff," he said slowly. "The brink was crumbling under his fingers, and the only thing near enough to grasp was a tuft of grass, a few long blades with roots barely clinging to the rock. The only chance he had of climbing back up on the cliff. So he grabbed it." His abrupt chuckle held no mirth. "He had known it would pull free."
"Did you save him?" Rand asked. But Asmodian did not answer. As Rand started for the doorway, the sounds of the march of death began again behind him. The strings of beads fell together behind him, and the five maidens who had been waiting in the wide, empty hall flowed easily to their feet from where they had been squatting on the pale blue tiles. They were all but one tall for women, though not for Aiel women. Their leader, Adeline, lacked little more than a hand of being able to look him in the eyes. The exception, a fiery redhead named Enyla, was no taller than Egwene, and extremely touchy about being so short. Like the clan chiefs, their eyes were all blue or gray or green, and their hair, light brown or yellow or red, was cut short except for a tail at the nape of the neck. Full quivers balanced the long-bladed knives at their belts, and they wore cased horn bows on their backs. Each carried three or four short, long-bladed spears and a round bullhide buckler. Aiel women who did not want hearth and children had their own warrior society, Fardarai's Mai, the Maidens of the Spear. He acknowledged them with a small bow, which made them smile. It was not an Aiel custom, at least not the way he had been taught to do it.
"I see you, Adeline," he said.
"Where is Joinda?
I thought she was with you earlier. Has she taken ill?"
"I see you, Randalthor," she replied.
Her pale yellow hair seemed paler, framing her sun-dark face, which had a fine white scar across one cheek.
"In a way, she has. She has been talking to herself all day, and not an hour ago she went off to lay a bridal wreath at the feet of Garan, of the Girad Goshin."
Some of the others shook their heads. Marrying meant giving up the spear.
"Tomorrow is his last day as her Gaishain. Joinda is Blackrock Sharad," she added significantly.
It was significant. Marriages came frequently with men and women taken Gaishain, but very seldom between clans with blood feud. even blood feud in abeyance.
"It is an illness that spreads," Anila said heatedly. Her voice was usually as hot as her hair. "One or two maidens make their bridal wreaths every day since we came to Rudian."
Rand nodded with what he hoped they took for sympathy. It was his fault. If he told them, he wondered how many would still risk staying near him.
All, probably.
Honor would hold them, and they had no more fear than the clan chiefs. At least it was only marriages so far. Even maidens would think marrying better than what some had experienced. Maybe they would. "I will be ready to go in a moment," he told them.
"We will wait with patience," Adeline said.
It hardly seemed patience. Standing there, they all appeared poised on the edge of sudden movement. It really did take him only a moment to do what he wanted, weave flows of spirit and fire into a box around the room and tie them so the weave held on its own. Anyone could go in or out, except a man who could channel. For himself, or Asmodian, walking through that doorway would be like walking through a wall of solid flame. He had discovered the weave, and that Asmodian, blocked, was too weak to channel through it, by accident. No one was likely to question the doings of a gleeman, but if someone did, Jason Natale had simply chosen to sleep as far from Aiel as he could manage in Rudian. That was a choice that Hadnan Kadir's drivers and guards at least could sympathize with. And this way, Rand knew exactly where the man was of a night. The maidens asked him no questions. He turned away. The maidens followed him, spread out and wary as if they expected an attack right there. Asmodian was still playing the lament. Arms outstretched to either side, Matt Cawthon walked the wide, white coping of the dry fountain, singing to the men who watched him in the fading light. "We'll drink the wine till the cup is dry, and kiss the girls so they'll not cry, and toss the dice until we fly to dance with Jack of the Shadows." The air felt cool after the day's heat, and he thought briefly of buttoning up his fine green silk coat with the golden embroidery, but the drink the Aiel called usquai had put a buzz in his head like giant flies, and the thought flittered away. The white stone figures of three women stood on a platform in the dusty basin, 20 feet tall and unclothed. Each been made with one hand upraised, the other holding a huge stone jar tilted over her shoulder, for water to pour from. But one was missing her head and upraised hand, and on another the jar was a shattered ruin. "We'll dance all night while the moon runs free, and dandle the lasses upon our knee, and then you'll ride along with me to dance with Jack of the Shadows."
"A fine song to be singing about death,"
one of the wagon drivers shouted in a heavy Lugarter accent. Kadir's men kept themselves in a tight knot apart from the Aiel men around the fountain. They were all tough, hard-faced men, but every one was sure any Aiel would slit his throat for a wrong glance. They were not far wrong.
"I heard my old grandmother talk about Jack of the Shadows," the big-eared Lugarter went on. "'Tisn't right to sing about death that way."
Matt Muzzley considered the song he had been singing and grimaced. No one had heard "Dance with Jack of the Shadows," since Aldishar fell. In his head, he could still hear the defiant song rising as the Golden Lions launched their last futile charge at Artur Hawkwing's encircling army. At least he had not been babbling it in the old tongue. He was not as juicy as he looked by half, but there had indeed been too many cups of usquai. The stuff looked and tasted like brown water, but it hit your head like a mule's kick.
"Moraine will pack me off to the tower yet if I'm not careful. At least it would get me out of the waste and away from Rand."
Maybe he was drunker than he thought, if he considered that a fair trade. He shifted to "Tinker in the Kitchen."
"Tinker in the kitchen with a job of work to do. Mistress up above, slipping on a robe of blue. She dances down the staircase, her fancy all so free, crying, 'Tinker, oh dear Tinker, won't you mend a pot for me?'"
Some of Kadir's men joined in the song as he danced back to where he had begun. The Aiel did not. Among them, men did not sing except for battle chants or laments for the slain.
and neither did maidens, except among themselves. Two Aiel men were squatting on the coping, showing none of the effects of the usquai they had consumed, unless their eyes were the faintest bit glassy. He would be glad to get back where light-colored eyes were a rarity. Growing up, he had not seen anything but brown or black, except on Rand. A few pieces of wood, wormholed arms and legs from chairs, lay on the broad paving stones in the area left open by the watchers. An empty red pottery crock lay beside the coping, as did another that still held usquai, and a silver cup. The game was to take a drink, then try to hit a target thrown into the air with a knife. None of Kadir's men and few of the Aiel would dice with him, not when he won as often as he did, and they did not play at cards. Knife throwing was supposed to be different, especially with usquai added in. He had not won as often as he did with dice, but half a dozen worked gold cups and two bowls lay inside the basin beneath him, along with bracelets and necklaces set with rubies or moonstones or sapphires, and a scattering of coins as well. His flat-crowned hat and an odd spear with a black haft rested beside his winnings. Some of it was even Aiel-made. They were more likely to pay for something with a piece of loot than with a coin. Corman, one of the Aiel on the coping, looked up at him as he cut off singing. A white scar slanted across his nose.
"You are nearly as good with knives as you are with dice, Matrim Cawthon. Shall we call it an end? The light is failing."
"There's plenty of light."
Matt squinted at the sky. Pale shadows covered everything here in the valley of Rudion, but the sky was still light enough to see against, at least.
"My grandmother could make the throw in this. I can make it blindfolded."
Jenrik, the other squatting Aiel, peered around the onlookers.
"Are there women here?"
Built like a bear, he considered himself a wit.
"The only time a man talks like that is when there are women to impress."
The maidens scattered through the crowd laughed as hard as anyone else, and maybe harder.
"You think I can't?"
Matt muttered, ripping off the dark scarf he wore around his neck to hide the scar where he had once been hung.
"Just shout now when you throw it up, Corman."
Hastily, he tied the scarf around his eyes and drew one of his knives from his sleeve. The loudest sound was the watcher's breathing. "Not drunk? I'm juicier than a fiddler's whelp." And yet he suddenly felt his luck, felt that surge the way he did when he knew which spots would show before the dice stopped tumbling. It seemed to clear his head a little.
"Throw it," he murmured calmly.
"Now,"
Corman called, and Matt's arm whipped back, then forward. In the stillness, the thunk of steel stabbing wood was as loud as the clatter of the target on the pavement. No one said a word as he pulled the scarf back down around his neck. A piece of a chair arm, no bigger than his hand, lay in the open space, his blade stuck firmly in the middle. Corman had tried to shave the odds, it appeared. Well, he had never specified the target. He suddenly realized he had not even made a wager. Finally, one of Kadir's men half-shouted,
"The Dark One's own luck, that."
"Luck is a horse to ride like any other," Matt said to himself, no matter where it came from. Not that he knew where his luck came from. He only tried to ride it as best he could. As quietly as he had spoken, Jenrik frowned up at him.
"What was that you said, Matrim Cawthon?"
Matt opened his mouth to repeat himself, then closed it again as the words came clear in his mind.
"Senesovia kabadonde, ein dovinia."
The old tongue.
"Nothing," he muttered, "just talking to myself."
The onlookers were beginning to drift away.
"I guess the light really is fading too much to go on."
Corman put a foot on the piece of wood to wrench Matt's knife free and brought it back to him.
"Some time again, maybe, Matrim Cawthon, some day."
That was the Aiel way of saying never, when they did not want to say it right out. Matt nodded as he slipped the blade back into one of the sheaths inside his sleeve. It was the same as the time he had rolled 6 sixes 23 times in a row. He could hardly blame them. Being lucky was not all it was made out. He noted with a bit of envy that neither Aiel staggered in the slightest as they joined the departing crowd. Scrubbing a hand through his hair, Matt sat down heavily on the coping. The memories that had once cluttered his head like raisins in a cake now blended with his own. In one part of his mind, he knew he had been born in the Two Rivers 20 years before. But he could remember clearly leading the flanking attack that turned the Trollocs at Myganda, and dancing in the court of Tarmanduin, and 100 other things. 1,000. Mostly battles. He remembered dying more times than he wanted to think of. No seams between lives anymore. He could not tell his memories from the others unless he concentrated. Reaching behind him, he set his wide-brimmed hat on his head and fished the odd spear across his knees. Instead of an ordinary spearhead, it had what looked like a 2-foot sword blade, marked with a pair of ravens. Lan said that that blade had been made with the One Power during the War of the Shadow, the War of the Power. The warder claimed it would never need sharpening and never break. Matt thought he would not trust that unless he had to. It might have lasted 3,000 years, but he had little trust of the power. Cursive script ran along the black haft, punctuated at either end with another raven, inlaid in some metal even darker than the wood. In the old tongue, but he could read it now, of course. Thus is our treaty written. Thus is agreement made. Thought is the arrow of time. Memory never fades. What was asked is given. The price is paid. One way down the wide street, half a mile off, was a square that would have been called large in most cities. The Aiel traders were gone for the night, but their pavilions still stood, made of the same grayish-brown wool used for Aiel tents. Hundreds of traders had come to Ruidian from every part of the waste for the biggest fair the Aiel had ever seen, and more arrived every day. The traders had been among the first to actually start living in the city. Matt did not really want to look the other way, toward the great plaza. He could make out the shapes of Kadir's wagons, awaiting more loading tomorrow. What appeared to be a twisted redstone door frame had been heaved into one that afternoon. Moraine had taken particular care to see it lashed firmly in place, just as she wanted. He did not know what she knew of it, and he was not about to ask. Better if she forgot he was alive, though small chance of that. But whatever she knew, he was sure he knew more. He had stepped through it, a fool looking for answers. What he had gotten instead was a head full of other men's memories. That and dead. He tucked the scarf closer around his neck. And 2 other things. A silver fox head medallion that he wore under his shirt, and the weapon across his knees. Small recompense. He ran his fingers lightly down the script. Memory never fades. They had a sense of humor fit for Aiel, those folk on the other side of that doorway.
Can you do that every time?
He jerked his head around to stare at the maiden who had just sat down beside him. Tall, even for an Aiel, maybe taller than he was. She had hair like spun gold and eyes the color of a clear morning sky. She was older than he, maybe by 10 years, but that had never put him off. Then again, she was Fardar Aizmai.
I am Melindra, she went on, of the Jumai Sept. Can you do that every time?
She meant the knife-throwing, he realized. She gave her sept, but no clan. Aiel never did that, unless... She had to be one of the Shido maidens, who had come to join Rand. He did not really understand all this about societies, but as for Shido, he remembered them trying to stick spears in him too well. Culloden did not like anyone associated with Rand, and what Culloden hated, the Shido hated. On the other hand, Melindra had come here to Ruidian, a maiden. But she wore a small smile. Her gaze held an inviting light.
Most of the time, he said truthfully.
Even when he did not feel it, his luck was good. When he did, it was perfect. She chuckled, her smile widening, as if she thought he was boasting. Women seemed to make up their minds whether you were lying without looking at the evidence. On the other hand, if they liked you, they either did not care or else decided even the most outrageous lie was true. Maidens could be dangerous, whatever their clan. Any woman could. He had learned that on his own. But Melindra's eyes were definitely not just looking at him. Dipping into his winnings, he pulled up a necklace of gold spirals, each centered on a deep blue sapphire, the largest as big as the joint of his thumb. He could remember a time, his own memory, when the smallest of those stones would have made him sweat. "They'll look pretty with your eyes," he said, laying the heavy strand in her hands. He had never seen a maiden wear baubles of any sort, but in his experience, every woman liked jewelry. Strangely, they liked flowers nearly as well. He did not understand it, but then he was willing to admit that he understood women less than he did his luck, or what had happened on the other side of that twisted doorway. "Very fine work," she said, holding it up. "I accept your offer." The necklace disappeared into her belt pouch, and she leaned over to push his hat back on his head. "Your eyes are pretty, like dark polished cat's eye." She twisted around to pull her feet up onto the coping and sat with her arms wrapped around her knees, studying him intently. "My spear sisters have told me about you." Matt pulled his hat back into place and watched her warily from under the brim. What had they told her? And what offer? It was only a necklace. The invitation was gone from her eyes. She looked like a cat studying a mouse. That was the trouble with maidens of the spear. Sometimes it was hard to tell whether they wanted to dance with you, kiss you, or kill you. The street was emptying, the shadows deepening, but he recognized Rand slanting across down the way, pipe clenched between his teeth. He was the only man in Rudion likely to be walking with a fistful of Fardarai's Mai. They're always around him, Matt thought, guarding him like a pack of she-wolves, leaping to do whatever he says. Some men might have envied him that much, at least. Not Matt. Not most of the time. If it had been a pack of girls like Isendra, now... "Excuse me for a moment," he told Melindra, hurriedly. Leaning his spear against the low wall around the fountain, he leaped up, already running. His head still buzzed, but not so loudly as before, and he did not stagger. He had no worries about his winnings. The Aiel had very definite views of what was allowed. Taking in a raid was one thing, theft another. Kadir's men had learned to keep their hands in their pockets after one of them had been caught stealing. After a beating that left him striped from shoulders to heels, he had been sent away. The one water bag he had been allowed would not have been nearly enough for him to reach the dragon wall, even if he had had any clothes on. Now Kadir's men would not pick up a copper they found lying in the street. "Rand?" The other man walked on with his encircling escort. "Rand!" Rand was not even 10 paces away, but he did not waver. Some of the maidens looked back, but not Rand. Matt felt cold suddenly, and it had nothing to do with the onset of night. He wet his lips and spoke again, not a shout. "Luz Theron!" And Rand turned around. Matt almost wished he had not. For a time, they only looked at one another in the twilight. Matt hesitated about going closer. He tried telling himself it was because of the maidens. Adeline had been one of those who taught him a so-called game, Maiden's Kiss, that he was never likely to forget. Or play again, if he had any say in it. And he could feel Anila's gaze like an auger boring into his skull. Who would have expected a woman to go up like oil thrown on a fire just because you told her she was the prettiest little flower you had ever seen? Rand now. He and Rand had grown up together. They and Perrin, the blacksmith's apprentice back in Emmons Field, had hunted together, fished together, tramped through the sandhills to the edge of the mountains of mist, camped under the stars. Rand was his friend. Only now he was the kind of friend who might bash your head in without meaning to. Perrin could be dead because of Rand. He made himself walk to arm's reach of the other man. Rand was nearly a head taller, and in the early evening gloom, he seemed taller yet, colder than he had been.
"I've been thinking, Rand."
Matt wished he did not sound hoarse. He hoped Rand would answer to his right name this time.
"I've been away from home a long time."
"We both have," Rand said softly. "A long time." Suddenly he gave a laugh, not loud, but almost like the old Rand.
"Are you beginning to miss milking your father's cows?"
Matt scratched his ear, grinning a bit.
"Not that, exactly."
If he never saw the inside of another barn, it would be too soon.
"But I was thinking that when Kadir's wagons go, I might go with them."
Rand was silent. When he spoke again, the brief flash of mirth was gone.
"All the way to Tarvalin?"
It was Matt's turn to hesitate.
"He wouldn't give me away to Moraine, would he?"
"Maybe,"
he said casually.
"I don't know.
That's where Moraine will want me. Maybe I'll find a chance to get back to the Two Rivers. See if everything's all right at home.
See if Perrin's alive. See if my sisters are, and Mother, and Da. We all have to do what we must, Matt. Not what we want to, very often. What we must." It sounded like an excuse to Matt, as if Rand was asking him to understand.
Only he had done what he had to himself a few times.
"I can't blame Perrin on him, not by himself. Nobody bloody forced me to follow after Rand like some bloody heel hound." Only that was not true either. He had been forced, just not by Rand.
"You won't stop me leaving?"
"I don't try to tell you to come or go, Matt," Rand said wearily. "The wheel weaves the pattern, not me. And the wheel weaves as the wheel wills." "For all the world, like a bloody Aes Sedai." Half turning to go, Rand added, "Don't trust Kadir, Matt. In some ways, he's about as dangerous a man as you ever met. Don't trust him an inch, or you might get your throat slit. And you and I wouldn't be the only ones to regret that." Then he was gone, down the street in the deepening dusk, with the maidens around him like slinking wolves. Matt stared after him. Trust the merchant? I wouldn't trust Kadir if he was tied in a sack. So Rand did not weave the pattern. He came close. Before ever any of them learned that the prophecies had anything to do with them, they had learned that Rand was Tavirin, one of those rare individuals who, instead of being woven willy-nilly into the pattern, instead forced the pattern to shape itself around them. Matt knew about being Tavirin. He was one himself, though not as strong as Rand. Sometimes Rand could affect people's lives, change the course of them, just by being in the same town. Perrin was Tavirin as well, or maybe had been. Moraine had thought it was significant finding three young men who grew up in the same village all destined to be Tavirin. She meant to fit them all into her plans, whatever they were. It was supposed to be a grand thing. All the Tavirin Matt had been able to learn about had been men like Arthur Hawkwing, or women like Mabriam and Shireed, whose stories had said founded the compact of the 10 nations after the breaking. But none of the stories told what happened when one Tavirin was close to another as strong as Rand. It was like being a leaf in a whirlpool. Melindra stopped beside him and handed him his spear and a heavy, coarse-woven sack that clinked.
"I put your winnings in this for you."
She was taller than he was, by a good 2 inches. She glanced after Rand.
"I heard you were near brother to Rand Althor."
"In a manner of speaking," he said dryly.
"It does not matter," she said dismissively,
and concentrated her gaze on him, fists on her hips.
"You attracted my interest, Matt Cawthon, before you gave me a regard gift. Not that I will give up the spear for you, of course, but I have had my eye on you for days. You have a smile like a boy about to do mischief. I like that. And those eyes."
In the failing light, her grin was slow and wide and warm.
"I do like your eyes."
Matt tugged his hat straight, though it had not been crooked.
from pursuer to pursued in the blink of an eye. It could happen like that with Aiel women, especially maidens. Does Daughter of the Nine Moons mean anything to you? It was a question he asked women sometimes. The wrong answer would send him out of Rudion tonight if he had to try walking out of the waste. Nothing, she said. But there are things I like to do by moonlight. Putting an arm around his shoulder, she took off his hat and began to whisper in his ear. In no time at all, he was grinning even more widely than she.